326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. Up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We will also hear the set list. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, great mix of music. Patchy frost overnight, lows 34 to 38, and showers likely tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs near 55, winds from the northwest 5 to 10, gusting higher. Up next, As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
That won't wash. In the face of Donald Trump's tariff talk and 51st state threats, many Canadians are buying local, but investigations have confirmed a number of instances of false advertising on supposedly made in Canada products. And our guest says it is high time retailers came clean about the practice that has come to be known as maple washing.
And mash hysteria. A British grocery chain isn't just talking the talk, it's guacking the guac, by which I mean it's using a new scanner to determine the exact ripeness of the mysterious, secretive avocado.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few moments here on People Powered KAXE. Right now, though, we're going to take a listen to our album of the week, Hard-Headed Woman by Margot Price. This is her fifth studio album, and she is kicking off the tour for this album at none other than Grand Rapids River Fest this Saturday. Find your tickets at grandrapidsriverfest.com. The song we're going to hear from Margot Price this evening is called Wild at Heart.
Everybody's had a few. Nothing to say, same old lies. I've been fine, baby, how about you? Smaller the talk, the bigger the lies. Wrote some words on a receipt, folded into a paper rose. It's been too long to recall why we started off on this road. This place holds a lot of memories, a lot of
This is the set list on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. Grand Rapids River Fest is here this Saturday, September 6th at the Public Library Amphitheater close to the banks of the Mississippi River. Here's info on all four artists on the lineup. This year's headliner is Courtney Barnett, an Australian indie rocker acclaimed for her witty observations on the everyday and mundane. all in her trademark deadpan delivery. Besides her songwriting, Barnett is a modern guitar hero whose playing ranges from delicate to total shredding and makes her live show can't miss. Just before Courtney is the outlaw country maverick Margot Price, fresh off the release of Hard-Headed Woman, her fantastic new fifth album. Since her 2016 debut, Price has been a breath of fresh air in the country music world. Her current band features flat-picking prodigy and vocalist Logan Ledger, and they easily take listeners to the funky, rocking, and psychedelic corners of country music. Playing second this year is rising Canadian roots musician Jeremy Albino, my pick for this year's biggest surprise. If Albino is new to you, you're in for a retro-rocking and magnetic stage performer who brings to mind the early days of rock and roll music. This year's opener is Minnesota's own Alan Sparhawk, a northern Minnesota institution since the mid-90s with acclaimed indie rock band Low. His most recent project was a collaboration with fellow Duluth musicians Trampled by Turtles, a cathartic album that navigated his grief after the death of life and musical partner Mimi Parker. Now his live band includes his son Cyrus on bass, and Dave from Trampled by Turtles will be joining him this Saturday. Gates open at 2 p.m. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Running on empty, the mayor of Conception Bay South in Newfoundland and Labrador says it came as a huge shock to hear his town had mere hours until it was completely out of water, mere weeks after facing the threat of fire.
Hot under the cauliflower, a steely-eyed Ontario grocery shopper has been IDing products that are labeled Canadian but are actually American. And she wants Ottawa to do more to deter so-called maple washing.
No class action. Students at Dalhousie University are in limbo right now. A lockout means classes are suspended. A professor tells us instructors and students are equally eager to get the semester started.
A pigment of their imaginations. Researchers in Costa Rica could hardly believe the images of an entirely orange shark and are discussing it using some pretty colorful language.
Beauty and the Beasts. An indigenous weaver in Alaska is making the ultra-popular labubu a lot less monstrous by crafting custom regalia for them.
And I'd like to propose an avocado toast, and a British supermarket chain wants to help with that. It is deploying new high-tech scanners that will tell me whether an avocado is ripe enough to mash. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that tried to make guacamole with an unripe avocado, but it was too hard. It's been a dramatic 24 hours in Conception Bay South. Yesterday afternoon, residents of one of the largest municipalities in Newfoundland and Labrador were told that they were mere hours from completely running out of water because of a water main break. All businesses were forced to close immediately. The first day of school was postponed, and people were told to only use water for emergencies if they even had any in their taps. The town wanted to be sure it had water set aside. Last month, Conception Bay South was placed under a state of emergency, and some residents were forced to flee because of an out-of-control wildfire. Darren Bent is the mayor of Conception Bay South. We reached him there earlier today.
Mayor Bent, I know there's been a little bit of an update, a significant one as well. What is the latest?
Well, the latest, I guess, is we've been allowing water back into our system throughout the day. Overnight, early into this morning, the repairs were successful. Water has been flowing through the piping and into our reserve tanks throughout the day. We're trying to get to a level of water where we have it's secured enough pressure for emergency services if necessary before we lift the state of emergency that we put in place yesterday. And of course, that state of emergency has brought our business community to a halt, unfortunately, and it's been difficult for them, as you can imagine, to be closed down for a couple of days due to this no water problem. One thing that is happening right now is that most of the community is returning home from work. Yeah. And of course, we're going to prey on their good nature a little bit longer this evening, but we need them to really follow the conservation order that we have in to not use water unless it's for emergency use. so we can get to the levels that we need. Then we can lift the state of emergency, let businesses go back to doing what they need to do. And of course, the first day of school was supposed to be today here in the town. Hopefully it'll be tomorrow.
As mayor, obviously, it's your job to deal with crises and handle things. You're prepared for them to a certain extent. But what was it like to learn that this was going to be happening? This was the situation.
It was quite jarring, to be honest with you. We just came through a serious threat of wildfires, both on the west and east end of our towns. That was a crisis that we depended on our neighbors for help with to ensure the safety of our residents and our structures and so forth. And then yesterday, just after lunchtime, to find out that the water had stopped flowing to the town completely on the, through the main line somehow. We weren't sure what the reason was right away, but we were able to find out, you know, in fairly short order that the pipe had burst and there was no water heading to Conception Bay South. And then the reality was is that we probably had 3 or 4 hours left of water and the tanks and the lines would have been dry. And, of course, many residents last night had no water. But it was a terrible feeling to have to go through something like this.
Yeah.
It's never happened in the town before, and I hope it never does. But, you know, you can't predict these sorts of things, I suppose.
Any sense of what caused that pipe to burst?
No, time and pressure, probably. Who knows? We haven't gotten reports. The city of St. John's owns the infrastructure. It's not actually in our town, so we're waiting for, you know, updates from them as to what it was. But we're talking about concrete pipe. Somewhere between 450 and 500 millimeter pipe, about 50 years old. So time and pressure, maybe.
Even without that break, that pipe bursting, it has been a very dry summer. But a lot of people will be asking, and I'm sure they're coming up to you and asking, how did things get to this point? How did things get so bad?
Well, you know, with the wildfire situation, it was a matter of, you know, we didn't have much of a winter. We didn't have much rain in May or June, which is unheard of in this area. And then we had one of the hottest summers that we've seen, 30 plus degree temperatures. And, you know, the province was hit by wildfires from, you know, one end to the other. And some places, you know, are suffering with great devastation. Our friends at Conception Bay North suffered greatly from the Kingston fire. We were spared primarily, no structural damage here. You know, one of the things that we're learning, and I, you know, and forget about the water main break from this one, but one of the things that we're learning, you can call it climate change or whatever you want to call it, but the truth is that these types of things, whether it's bad storms, winter storms that are becoming, and things like this, what near what I would consider almost drought conditions compared to what we're normally used to here, you know, are happening more frequently. They're much more devastating than they used to be. And the concern is they're much more predictable and unpredictable. I mean, and, you know, what used to be 50, 100-year events are happening much more, you know, closer together. And it's something that we have to deal with. And it's, you know, it's a cost for all municipalities to, you know, to be mindful of these things and try to be as prepared as possible. But, you know, for wildfires that we, you know, we saw this summer, I'm not sure that anybody expected anything like this, and how they started, we don't know. And then all of a sudden, the water main break. We had a water main break a year or so ago on our main line within the town, and we got it repaired in short order, and everything was fine. It didn't affect everybody in town. But, you know, a couple hundred meters of repair cost $2.5 million. And so, you know, we're that line from Bay Bulls Big Pond to Conception Bay South is 22 kilometers.
So knowing what you know, having been through in your community, what you've been through just this summer, what can you do in your capacity as mayor to keep something like this from happening again?
There's no way we can stop infrastructure outside of our town from breaking down, really. What we can do is we can investigate other ways of water and backup water modes for our town. You know, the Northeast Avalon is an area, you know, Conception Bay South, Town of Paradise, City of Mount Pearl, City of St. John's has grown greatly over the past number of years. Our town and our neighbors in Paradise are probably two of the fastest growing municipalities in the area. And water is a concern for us. You know, there's houses being built at elevations they've never been built at before. It's a big issue. And, you know, there's no easy solutions. And it's certainly there's no cheap solutions.
Mayor, I'm glad we could speak. Please take care.
All right, Neil. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Darren Bent is the mayor of Conception Bay South, Newfoundland and Labrador. That's where we reached him earlier today. And just before we went to air, water levels reached an adequate threshold for the state of emergency to end, and businesses were told they were allowed to reopen. Students at Dalhousie University are getting nervous about the first day of school. Not so much what will happen on that day, but when that first day will happen. Most classes on the Halifax campus have been cancelled due to an ongoing contract dispute between the university and the Dalhousie Faculty Association. Members of the association have been off the job for 2 weeks after the university locked them out when the two parties weren't able to reach an agreement on a new contract. 2 days after the lockout started, the Faculty Association decided to go on strike. Kathy Causey is a professor in the Department of English at Dalhousie University. She was walking the picket line earlier today. We reached her in Halifax.
Professor, many classes are still cancelled today, as I understand it. How would you describe the energy on campus right now?
I would say that the faculty, at least, when I was on the picket line this morning, they're feeling a mix of grief and anger, but real confusion as well. This is unlike any other Labor Day that I've had. So there's a lot of mixed emotions. The students are mostly confused because some of their classes are starting, some of their classes aren't. On Friday, I was with the students who were moving in, the first year students, and they were very confused. And a little, not quite angry, but getting towards anger that they want classes to start.
In terms of communicating with students, as I understand it, you're also locked out of your Dalhousie email, as well as Brightspace, the platform where students get the materials for their classes. So how are you communicating with your students?
I actually downloaded my class list before we got locked out. So we are communicating with students via social media, signs, picketing, and so on. And there's a booth set up where they can come and ask us questions about the lockout and so on. But we're kind of at a disadvantage compared to the administration, which can email them directly.
At the heart of this, for you and your fellow staff, what is central to these negotiations for you?
I mean, first of all, we love teaching. We want to be back in class. And the board is trying to make it all about salary. And it is about salary because we have lost 9% of our salary by inflation. But if it were only about salary, we would have accepted the board's interest arbitration. And so a lot of the really important issues, and the reason that I'm out there, would have been abandoned, like limited term appointments, which were originally developed so that someone would cover the classes for someone who's on parental leave or whatever. Mm-hmm. These are 1 year appointments. They are paid exactly the same as a permanent employee. They get the same benefits. They get the same pension. But they have to reapply for their job every single year. And I know people who have been in these 1 year or 3 year rolling contracts for upwards of 10 years. And so what we're saying is, okay, pick a number after a certain number of years. This is no longer a limited term appointment. This is a permanent position. And the people in it, it could help so much. I was talking to a woman this morning who said that getting a permanent appointment let her leave a marriage, and that she would not have been able to leave that had she been on this 1 year rolling contract that she was before. And so there are real personal costs to not knowing whether you can start a family, whether you can buy a house, whether you will have a job next year. It's the same salary, it's the same benefits.
So why don't you think that you're coming to an agreement on that aspect?
Well, first of all, they won't talk to us, they won't negotiate, and they aren't at the table. They've locked us out, and they're not even. I don't know what they want from us, but I think they'd like keeping us precarious. And they can then, as they did last year, they cut, because they said they were in a budget crisis, they cut a lot of limited term appointments. And so when they make it all about salary, they're ignoring all of these things.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying on that front. Salary is a part of this. It may not be your priority. It is part of this dispute. Statistics Canada says the average annual salary for full-time teaching staff at Dalhousie last year was close to $160,000. Certainly that's a lot more than many people will ever see. So how do you justify the faculty association's demands on that issue?
First of all, there are several things that I want people to keep in mind. First of all, the Dalhousie board is pleading poverty. And that's true if you only look at the operating account. They are talking about the operating budget, but every year that I've been here, and I've been here since 2007, they have transferred money, surplus, out of the operating fund into the overall budget. There's lots of evidence in the overall budget that they are not as poor as they are pretending. The most obvious one is they're building a brand new hockey rink, which is great, but it doesn't help me teach English or my colleagues teach math. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think university should be about. Secondly, I think the DFA is really concerned about is those early career academics who are earning much less than $150,000. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in the good old days, Halifax was a sleepy little town by the ocean, and you could attract people here with, you know, its quaintness and its lower standard of living. Cost of living in Halifax is on par with Toronto and so on. And a lot of these early career academics are finding it really hard to make a living. I've been on several job searches that have failed because we've offered the job to someone. They looked at the salary, they looked at the cost of living in Halifax, and they said, I can't afford to move there. We will go elsewhere.
You mentioned the newer staff on the lower end of the salary scale. The union, as I understand it, is not asking just for folks on that end to be boosted. They are asking for everyone to be boosted. Do you think, though, that it would be better in terms of negotiating to focus on those lower earning members at this stage?
Well, I'm not on the bargaining team, so I can't tell them what to do. But the point is, we are willing to negotiate. The board is not negotiating. I don't know what they would answer if the board came with a different proposal and said, okay, you're really worried about early career academics. How about we make a different scale for them as for the rest of you? That would be a proposal that we could then think about and deal with. But the way it is now, they're not even coming forward with a proposal.
Professor, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Kathy Causey is a professor in the Department of English at Dalhousie University. We reached her in Halifax. In a statement to As It Happens Today, Dalhousie University said it's facing sector-wide challenges that are, quote, substantial and pressing, but that it's working with the Faculty Association to reach a resolution to restore, quote, stability on campus and minimize further disruption for students, unquote. As journalists, we are taught to be wary of firsts because a lot of things described as firsts are actually seconds or thirds or umpteenths. And many of you are skeptical, too. In fact, if you were to tell us something we had described as a first of its kind occurrence was actually not a first, well, you would not be the first. Most scientists are similarly dubious, but a number of them are pretty sure they've got a genuine first on their hands in the form of a shark spotted last year off the coast of Costa Rica.
Che lindo, eh, ma.
No, hombre, ma, che.
Ma che.
Che es este color, eh?
Ma. Yo ese color no lo he visto así, ma, tan anaranjados, vamos, sí. Eso es lo que necesito, ma. Vea qué lindo, ma.
The sound of a group of sport fishers in Costa Rica laying eyes on a rare, entirely bright orange nurse shark last August. Researchers from Costa Rica, Venezuela, and Brazil now say that that sighting is the first of its kind, and they're attributing it to not one genetic mutation, but two. Daniel Arauz Naranjo is a biologist with Costa Rica's Rescue Center for Endangered Marine Species and a co-author of a newly published paper on that shark. We reached him in San Jose, Costa Rica.
Daniel, that's how the fishermen reacted. They thought it was beautiful. A lot of wows going on there. You first saw it in a photograph, not a video, not up close. What did you think?
Well, I thought it was, like, my reaction was the same. So these fishers actually sent these pictures and these videos to a very close friend of mine,
yeah,
who is a sea turtle biologist in the Caribbean of Costa Rica. And yeah, he contacted me and he was like, hey, Daniel, take a look at these pictures. This is something that we have never seen before. And yeah, as soon as I saw it, I was like, what? That is crazy. Like, I've seen nurse sharks a lot and I've never seen one with that coloration, right? So it was very, very impressive.
And what kind of work have you and your colleagues done since then to try to figure out why it is this orange color?
Well, this is a mutation. When we first saw the yellow coloration or the orange coloration, we first thought about this mutation called sanctism. And then sanctism it's a mutation that happens in nature. It has been reported in reptiles. It has been reported in freshwater fish. But this is the first time that it has ever been reported on a shark. And then when we were analyzing the pictures and, you know, showing the pictures to other researchers, they noticed that the eyes of the shark were also, like, very white. And this is a sign of albinism as well. So it turns out that this cross mutation between albinism and sanctism has happened in nature before, and it actually accentuates the yellow color. So that is why it is so bright, right? And, you know, it could be something that the environment might have something to do, or it was just mainly just a random genetic mutation, right, that happened. So now, yeah, it's getting a lot of attention. Yeah. We are talking to people in the University of Costa Rica. A lot of people are wanting to go and see if we can catch it again, see if there is more of them, maybe. So, yeah, we'll see. Right now, we're just very excited about all the attention that the shark...
I wonder how the shark might feel about that. But we should mention the fishermen at that time, they let it go. You know, they didn't capture it and kill it. It's out there.
They didn't kill it. Yeah, exactly. It's still there.
But the issue of the mutation, how do you know that it really is a first here?
Well, we checked on all the reported literature that has been published in Science. We managed to come across a person back, like, in the late 50s or 60s that reported some yellowish nurse sharks from the Gulf of Mexico. But, you know, since then there was no cameras or anything like that, then we couldn't actually know if this is the same case of mutation that we are seeing right now. But, you know, looking at all the literature around the world, there have been some cases of albinism in sharks that have been reported. But this is the first time that we have actually reported yellow-orange shark with this condition.
It's not easy being different sometimes. I don't know what it's like under the sea, so to speak. But do you think this is a hindrance or an advantage?
Well, normally in nature, it depends on the species that you are. It could be a hindrance, right? Like if you are, you know, if you are bright colored than predators, it might be easier for them to detect you. But then if you're a nurse shark as well, nurse sharks have very, very few natural predators, right? So, you know, probably just for the fact that being a nurse shark and being in this environment, well, it's very muddy and the visibility is not good. They live in very murky waters. So probably, who knows, nobody even noticed that there was a orange shark around, and it managed to survive now. And it's an adult. It's a pretty good size and it was very energetic. So it seems like it's doing very well.
More questions to answer, I'm sure, in your mind. They let it go, which we said, as we said, is great, but it's not tagged. You have no way of tracking it. What would you like to answer next?
So our next question, or the next question that we have, is actually if it's a one-off case or if there's actually more of this happening, right? Like some mutations can be triggered by, you know, the environment, right? So climate change and the water conditions might be something that could trigger these mutations. So the next question that we have is if there are more of them. So yeah, we want to keep on going with these fishers. We have to keep in touch with them to try to see if, you know, if we can get to see more of them, or if maybe this was just a one-off thing that happened.
And our producer on this story spoke with one of the fishermen who was operating the tour, and he said he still couldn't believe how much attention this is getting, you know, even so long after the discovery. Can you believe how much attention this is getting? I mean, are you surprised or are you happy?
Oh man, we were it totally caught us by surprise. Like, Like, I mean, we knew it was a nice discovery. It took us almost a year to get to publish it in the scientific literature. And you know, once it was out there, it has just been unprecedented. We have been having calls from all newspapers from all around the world. And, you know, we have been trying to get the fishers to get all the attention that they can as well, because, you know, in the end, they were the ones that discovered it, yeah. Right? And so the fact that we still have this thing happening in close to us, you know, surprising everyone, and the fact that, you know, the ocean still holds things that are unknown to us and to science, it's unbelievable, right? And it gives us another reason to try to protect these environments.
Daniel, I appreciate this. Thank you. I'm really glad we could speak.
You're welcome. No, thank you.
Daniel Arauz-Naranjo is the co-author of a new study on a first-of-its-kind, we think, bright orange nurse shark published in the peer-reviewed journal Marine Biodiversity. We reached him in San Jose, Costa Rica. Now, come with me if you dare, and we'll enter the shadowy world of the mysterious avocado. What is it? Where does it come from? How do we know when it's ripe? And what is it? These questions have plagued humanity for millennia. And some people will try to tell you an avocado is a fruit and that it originally comes from Mesoamerica. But those are just facts. And the enigmatic avocado defies such reductive literality. Oh, I forgot to address the greatest mystery of all. How you know when a Hass avocado is ripe. Well, one time I asked a woman at the grocery store that, and she said, the skin should be a dark green color verging on black, and it should give slightly when you squeeze it gently. But how was I to follow such complicated instructions? So I continue to take home avocados so rock hard that I couldn't make guacamole, even by battering them with a tennis racket. Also, I broke my tennis racket. Now, though, at last, we are saved by the avocado ripeness scanner.
Avocados don't easily show their ripeness, leaving us puzzled which one to choose. They're perfect only for a very short period of time. Pinching is a proven method to ruin the avocado. The 1/3 avocado ripeness scanner can determine the ripeness without damaging the avocado. It scans through the avocado using light and can immediately detect its ripeness. Pinching days are over thanks to this avocado ripeness scanner.
The British grocery chain Tesco is trying out these avocado scanners made by the Dutch company 1/3 at 5 locations. The scanner will tell them if their avocado is ready to be mashed or not using, as you heard, light. Now, some argue that these are silly, that the weirdly vicious pinching described in that ad is unnecessary. And a high-tech gizmo is too, because a gentle squeeze will tell you all you need to know. But 1/3 says their product is preventing food waste, and if that's true, that's great. Finally, someone has solved a small part of the avocado mystery by literally shining a light on it. Here's Havaya Mighty with Avocado.
Look, this my shadow, don't get swallowed. Looking like Picasso, beauty can't be borrowed. Huh? And you adoring my bravado. Woke Americano, post a baby model. Yeah, I see you staring at my figure, trying to get up in the, that's just what I figure. And when I look into the mirror, I know I'm your trigger. I always do it bigger. You not as confident as I. Honestly, I'm known to make it hard to find your pride. Leader, so you probably got a smile shed in mine. Avocado shell so you can soften them inside. I be taking one step, you right on my heel. Did you fall in love yet? Do you want the real? Following me, I be taking one step, you right on my heel. Did you fall in love yet? Do you want the real? Following me, yeah. Following me, yeah. Yeah.
Society with Avocado.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, an Ontario shopper peers behind the maple leaves used to promote Made in Canada products and finds stars and stripes.
Plus, a hard-won victory. We'll hear from the newly crowned Canadian laughing champion and revisit an interview with an international laughing champ who once made a scene on a packed airplane for our benefit. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Leader, so you probably got a smile and shed in mine. Avocado shell, so you can soften them inside. I be taking one step, you right on my heel. Did you fall in love yet? Do you want the real?
Thank you for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from the Timberlake Lodge and Hotel in Grand Rapids. On-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar and the Grand Splash pool area with water slides and a hot tub. Further details at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Support also comes from Itasca County Health and Human Services hosting the 17th annual Community Connect Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing info on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. Patchy frost tonight with lows 34 to 38, and tomorrow showers likely mostly cloudy, highs near 55, and breezy northwest winds. There is more ahead from As It Happens.
For months now, Canadian shoppers have been seeking out a little maple leaf symbol on everything from produce to peanut butter. But what if that Buy Canadian label is being displayed on some items that are decidedly south of the border in origin? That mislabeling is being called maple washing, and the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has already identified 12 cases of grocery stores doing it. But so far, the agency has not issued any fines, and that's not sitting well with Brenda Nichols. She'd made it her mission to seek out and call out maple washing at her local grocery stores. We reached her in Hamilton, Ontario.
Brenda, I want to start with your most recent discovery. Tell me about the cauliflower.
Yes, my cauliflower story. I went to Fortino's and I was buying some produce, and I went to the Foodland Ontario display table and I saw some cauliflower. And I picked it up and I looked at it because I do check very closely, and it said product of USA. And it really upset me that they were putting international produce on the Foodland Ontario table. Mm-hmm. I brought it to the attention of one of the employees, mm-hmm. and he put his finger to his lips and he said, "Shh." And I said, "Why?" I said, "This shouldn't be on the Foodland Ontario table." And he said, "Why? Are we still mad at the Americans?" And then I brought up CFIA. And then he said, "Oh, okay, I'll have to move it."
He said "shh" to you? Like it?
Yes, he did. Like it was a big secret what they were doing.
And did they move it eventually?
I didn't go back and check until the next day, and either it was sold, and I couldn't find it in the produce aisle at all.
All right. And what kind of price difference do you notice for the things that are in the Ontario or the Canadian section compared to products from elsewhere?
I saw a table full of, not on the Foodland Ontario, of Canadian cauliflower, which I thought should have been displayed on the Foodland Ontario rather than tucked into the back corner. So as far as price, I'm not sure.
Okay. It was a CBC News investigation that first got you on this track, right?
Yes, it was. And I went to Fortino's and I started double and triple checking everything that I was buying. And I saw some blackberries that were product of Canada and they were labeled as such. I picked them up and they were from the USA. I did not file a complaint with CFIA. After that, I had shopped at a No Frills. And I found asparagus that was product of Canada, prepared in Canada. And upon checking the label further, it was a product of Peru that was distributed by a U.S. company. Mm-hmm. So it's happening a lot. Yeah,
it sounds like it. And why have you made it your mission to track these down and lodge these complaints?
I want to support the Ontario farmers and Canadian farmers, and the federal and the provincial government have asked us to buy Canadian, and not only in the produce aisle, but throughout the stores. Any product that I'm buying, I try and search out Canadian-made products. And I don't just go by the maple leaf because there's so much mislabeling. I was in the frozen fruit section at Fortino's, and there was a lot of Canadian flags. And I look, and the product is from Costa Rica. So you can't just go by their signage. You really have to double and sometimes triple check.
Yeah, and it's fine if those products are from other places, but you just want them to, you want to know that if it says maple leaf or Canadian, that's where it's actually from.
We're trying to do our part, and this is kind of a grassroots movement. It's been 7 months now, and the large grocery stores, I think, are making excuses where they haven't been fined by the CFIA. And I think what needs to happen is CFIA needs to step up and start fining the grocery stores so that they will make changes, because right now they just keep doing the same thing. I don't even know why we have so much produce from the USA when we have so many farmers and so much produce that's available, especially this time of year, from Canadian sources.
When you do get to speak to staff there or managers, what makes you think they're doing this deliberately and this isn't just a case of the sign was up and then new stock was put in and someone wasn't paying attention?
Well, different employees, they'll say, oh, it's not my problem. You know, it's a manager problem. Managers don't do anything. It's just repeat, repeat, repeat of the same thing. It's kind of enough is enough. And when the last employee last Saturday put his finger to his lips and said, shh, it was like he knew exactly what was happening, that they just wanted to move that particular produce, which was probably higher priced.
How long do you think you'll keep up this fight, this sleuthing?
I found a website that has stickers, and they were encouraging people, if we are finding things that are mislabeled, to stick the Product of USA stickers on the different products.
So it sounds like there's a, as you said, sort of this grassroots movement. There are others out there.
There's others. It's not just me. I certainly try to shop Canadian, and I try and shop now at independent grocer stores mm-hmm. that will bring in local produce. And the one I've been shopping at, they try and source within a 100-mile radius of their store for all the local produce.
The CFAA, as you were mentioning, they haven't issued any fines. If they continue on that track, what do you think will happen?
I don't think that the major grocery stores are going to change their behavior in any way unless there is some accountability. And as consumers, we can speak with our wallet, but it can't just be the consumers. I think the federal government, through the CFIA, needs to listen to our complaints. And I think more people actually, when they're finding USA products, that they need to alert the CFIA. And it only takes a minute or two to fill out a complaint form on the CFIA website.
Brenda, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We reached Brenda Nichols in Hamilton, Ontario, and we contacted a store manager at the Fortino's location that Ms. Nichols mentioned. She told us it was the first she'd heard about the mislabeled cauliflower, but that mistakes happen, and the store would take steps to educate its employees to avoid placing non-Canadian products in displays of homegrown produce. I don't need to explain what a labubu is, do I? I mean, no one can explain why a labubu is, but I assume you've seen the little furry bunny elf thing, dolls with their huge and frankly menacing eyes and their malevolent grins, it clipped onto people's purses and backpacks. The little monsters made by Chinese toy company Pop Mart have, for whatever reason, taken the world by storm, and now a Tlingit artist and Chilkat weaver is dressing them up a bit. Lily Hope is making tiny regalia for those looking to clothe their labubus in indigenous couture, which it turns out is quite a lot of people. We reached Ms. Hope in Juneau, Alaska.
Lily, I hear that if your hands aren't tied up with something else, you're pretty much always weaving. Are you weaving one of these pieces right now?
I am, yes.
How long does it take to finish one?
About a day and a half to 2 days.
Yeah. And what does the piece you're working on now look like? I've seen some of your photos on Instagram, and they're beautiful, the large scale ones and the small ones as well. But for those who haven't seen them yet, what do they look like?
The one I'm working on is six colors, red through purple. So they are naturally thigh-spun merino warps, a dancing fringe, and then the weft yarns that travel from the left side to the right side, or weft and white across the weaving, are finger-twined as if a woolen basket. So every stitch is either over twos or fours to create a... It looks more... this one looks a little bit like it could have false embroidery over it, but we call it a skip stitch pattern. And the way that the twos and fours are built, it does look like someone is laying stitches over the top to kind of create a raised edge.
As I said, they're beautiful pieces. What made you want to start doing them on this small scale, for such a popular, ubiquitous, divisive, some might say, toy?
I blame my children. I have five kids. And my 11, 10, and 7-year-olds have been collecting labubu for quite a few months, really obsessed with, you know, trying to get the surprise one or the secret one. I also did a series of blind boxes of earrings inspired by this blind box movement. But then my children were like, Mama, why don't you try making regalia? And huge credit to my eldest child, Nicholas, who sent me a few Instagrams from other makers in the U.S., indigenous artists who were doing quill work and bead work and making ribbon skirts. And I thought, well, we need some regalia from the Northwest Coast for these guys. So, you know, I just played with it and they kind of went viral.
Yeah, smart kids, Nicholas, labubu fans, thank you, clearly. But then you were selling it at a market in New Mexico. Right? How did people react there?
Right. 3 days before the market even happened, I was at an art show opening for a photographer, Kara Romero, and a curator from the East Coast saw this labubu, or said, hey, I saw that you're making these. Do you happen to have one on you? And I said, that's so funny. I almost brought them with me. She paid me up front and said, I will connect with you over the weekend. I'm going to pick this up and walk around with my indigenous labubu during market. So she did, and she brought a couple other people over to my booth and said, you know, can they buy regalia for theirs? And it just blew up from there.
And they're saying, get me one. How can I get one? What kind of price range are we talking about here, Lily? Because the dolls themselves, I don't know if dolls, monsters maybe is the better word, as you used, they're certainly not cheap. And that's like a mass market, you know, factory made product. Yours are handmade, as you said. What kind of price are we talking about?
I wish that I had tripled the prices because they are already such collectible items, but they are $700.
But you could triple them and people would pay it, is what you're saying?
I think so.
Wow.
I mean, that scares me a little bit because I want it to be, you know, compensating me more than an administrative assistant, right? Because the materials and the skill it takes to make them is valuable. But I'm also supporting five children on my single salary. Yeah. So I have to balance that.
It's your art as well as your commerce. This is clearly, I mean, you love weaving. It's a passion for you. How did you get into it in the first place?
I was 15 or 16 when my mother, Clarissa Rizal, started teaching me to weave, and I didn't love it. Really just wanted to hang out with my boys and go out and socialize, hang out in the woods, do teenager stuff. So she had these mandates of like, you're not going anywhere till you weave 6 rows. And back then, it took me half an hour to weave across a 10-inch project. And it was a slog. It was a drag. But I finished my first work, which is still hanging in my public studio here in Juneau. Actually, there's a little sign that says Lily's first work, 1995. That dates me. But then in my early 20s, I moved back to Alaska from Colorado and started taking classes at the University of Alaska Southeast and fell into the memory of my hands moving the way my mother had taught me. And I liked the feeling of success or producing work in parallel with this weaving community. And the best part about being in class and being in community with people co-creating is the tea and cookies and the sharing of meatloaf recipes, yeah, and the joys and like roller coasters of so-and-so is taking their first, sure, learning how to ride a bicycle and all the highs and lows of being human. And in that sharing collective space and also creating art in tandem with other people's, like almost like parallel play, because we get to sit around and drink tea and eat cookies. So do I love that my mother taught me and I have legacy? Do I love that my children are doing this with me and inspiring me to make work? Do I love the feel of fiber in my hands? Sure. But I really do it for the cookies.
What do you think your mother might think of where you're at now after she had to prod you to get started?
Oh, I think she's laughing at me. I think she's chuckling and going, oh, that Lily. Oh, that Lily.
Well, Lily, such a pleasure to speak with you. Congratulations on the success. Please take care.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Lily Hope is a Tlingit artist and Chilkat weaver. We reached her in Juneau, Alaska. Kelly Podlubny is the king of cackling. Last weekend, the Vancouver man won the Canadian Laughing Championship. And he's not a one-hit wonder. To claim the title, he had to master the best diabolical laugh, funniest belly laugh, and best snort laugh. Here he is talking to Gloria Makarenko, host of On the Coast in Vancouver.
Well, the way you can win is through direct competition, meaning that different people will offer up sort of a different kind of laugh. So, for example, snort laughter, for example. And whoever, is the most popular, most contagious contestant will move on to the next round.
I see. So how many rounds did you have to get through?
Oh, gosh. So there was 8 different rounds that we had to get through.
8 rounds. How do you even get your mind in the space to compete like that?
Oh, it's just about unconditional laughter. If I am asked to laugh maniacally, I will do my best job I can to, just do some of my best maniacal laughter.
But you're a laughing yoga practitioner. That's intriguing for me as well. What does that involve?
Oh, so that's just involving getting together with other people and just laughing unconditionally. We do some little exercises to help encourage, different kinds of laughter. We do some movement exercises and a lot of deep breathing.
Let's pretend we're in a little bit of a class. Why don't you take us through how you get us laughing?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, if we start off with gradient laughter, we just sort of start off with a bit of a just kind of a fake chuckle, right? So, and then we can try and boost that up a little bit. So, and then if you sort of bring that up even more.
Yeah. That's the new Canadian laughing champion, Kelly Podlubny. It will surprise no one that Kelly is not the first award-winning laugher to appear on this program. In 2013, Carol Off reached American laughing champion Julie Ostro on a packed airplane waiting to take off from the San Diego airport. Here's that interview from our archives.
What does it sound like? What does the international winning laugh sound like?
And in case you're wondering, there are people looking back at me from their plane seat. You're welcome.
Is everyone laughing?
Yeah, I got some smiles and I got some laughter from 9A and a little bit of, that guy's still sleeping. That's pretty impressive. Hi. And I got a, you better be quiet. But that was a joke because I met Mike earlier. Mike, right?
Who's Mike?
Mike is in 11A. Met him as we were waiting for the flight.
So now you're on a plane. Are there people beside you?
Oh, this is a full flight. I almost didn't get on.
What are the people? Are you in a middle seat?
Yeah, of course. I'm in the middle seat.
I just want to ask you about some of the other kinds of laughing. I mean, so was it a particular kind of laughing you had to do?
Yes. The first part of the competition was in that elimination round where we actually it was more timed. I would say that Albert Nirnberg, who was the MC, he indicated when the laugh was done. So we did an evil laugh or, diabolical laugh, Alabama knee slapper, and the snort laugh. So those were elimination rounds. Those were short and, to me, not as real. When I was connecting with the other people and laughing, and that's when it triggered that real laugh. And it, bless you, Dan. Dan just sneezed, so I had to bless him.
Mm.
Yeah, so then when I was laughing for real and there was no limit on it, my muscle memory, my laughing muscles kicked in and I couldn't stop.
Some of the other laughs. Can you give us your best diabolical laugh?
I will be on this flight for 4 hours. Yeah.
That sounds evil.
And that might be why the plane is emptying. I think that might be why people are getting off the plane, Carol.
Okay, well, maybe see who leaves if you do your snort laugh. Okay, so then, how about the best multiplex guffaw? Julie, you are good. You have quite a range.
Thank you. I'm just thinking the people on their cell phone are probably not calling family members, but psychiatrists.
There's also a photo of you, Julie, and at winning it, there's a big cup or something. Did you get that cup?
I earned the cup, and it's between my legs now on the floor. So to describe the height of this, I'm sitting in my seat on the plane, and the cup almost reaches my knees.
Uh-huh. And that's what you got for winning the American Laughing Championships.
Absolutely. And I've had a ball. I've had a hoot and a half walking through the airport in San Diego and people asking me what that was for.
All right, Julie, before we let you go, one last, your favorite laugh. Give it to us. Okay. That's wonderful. Julie, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Carol.
From our archives, that was Carol Off talking to Julie Ostro, who had just been named American Laughing Champion in 2013.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.